Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a federal appeals court offers a stiff rebuke to Florida's Stop Woke Act, saying it committed, quote, the greatest First Amendment sin of all. Later, a former JEA lawyer and board member testifies they either don't know or can't remember key facts. Florida Times Union reporter David Bauerlein joins us with courtroom highlights. But first, a conservative appeals court smacks down the governor's signature law. A judge appointed by former President Trump last week called the Stop Woke Act, promulgated by Governor Ron DeSantis, a smokescreen for regulating speech. I'm joined now by criminal defense and civil rights attorney Matt Kachurgis, who has himself been deeply involved in Stop Woke legislation, though not this immediate case. Hey, Matt, welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. We also welcome your comments about the court decision or your questions about the Stop Woke law in general. You can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also tag us on Facebook, Instagram, or X. Matt, let's start off with the basics. What did this most recent order say?
Well, when the governor and the legislature passed what's been called the Stop Woke Act, or as the government framed it, the Individual Freedom Act, a series of lawsuits were spawned due to the nature of the regulation, which covered not only schools, K through college, but also the workplace and what employers could, instruction that they could provide their employees. And part of the statute prohibited employers from discussing what are called 8 prohibited concepts. And so this particular lawsuit that the appellate court just ruled on dealt with the employer aspect of the Stop Woke Act. And it found that the aspect of the legislation that purported to regulate what employers, private employers, what training that they could give to their employees was unconstitutional. And what's, you know, to kind of strip it down, what the government was trying to do is eliminate DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion instruction for its employees and anti-racism instruction and training. And so what the 11th Circuit, our appellate federal appellate court found was that it was unconstitutional, that you may disagree with those types of trainings and those concepts, but the government's barring any discussion of that is a bridge too far. It's unconstitutional, or as the court concluded, no matter how controversial the ideas, allowing the government to set the terms of the debate is poison, not the antidote. And so that's what the court found.
Pretty emphatic. The state had tried to argue that this was not a question of speech, but conduct. They were saying they were framing it as we're prohibiting these mandatory meetings at which this kind of content would be taught or instructed specifically to issues of diversity, equity, inclusion, or anything that made people feel bad about, you know, who they were fundamentally because of things that may have been done by other people that look like them. And the court said you can't tackle this as a you can't pretend that this is conduct related. It really is speech related, because if they are holding mandatory meetings, you know, the state didn't object to that. They only objected to mandatory meetings if they had this very specific instruction. And that's what the court found was speech related.
Yeah. The court in tackling that argument by the defense, or by the state, was that in order to determine whether the conduct was prohibited, you had to look as to what was being said in this meeting. They claimed that they were just regulating the meetings, but to determine whether it was conduct, they had to look at the content of the expression that was taking place in the meetings. If you were to espouse, information, ideology that was in line with what the governor and the legislature thought, hey, that conduct's fine. But it's only when you espouse ideology that ran contra to this legislation that all of a sudden it became a regulation of conduct. But the court framed it in order to determine whether it's conduct or speech, we have to look at what is being said, and therefore it's a regulation of speech, not conduct.
I'm talking with attorney Matt Kachurgis about Florida's Stop Woke Act, which last week, at least one element, got rejected by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Matt, there are these other elements to Stop Woke. One that you handled for a while, which was kind of the K through 12 level, of education. There's the college education component, and we can get to that in just a minute. But explain to us what happened with the K through 12 case. That was brought by some local people objecting to these rules, these stop woke rules being implemented in, you know, primary education.
Yeah, we've tackled the whole ball of wax. We went after all of it. Our problem was we were a little early to the punch. The court found that we didn't have standing because the various administrative regulations that ultimately got enacted to enforce the statute had not been enacted at the time we filed suit. And the court found we didn't have standing because standing gets evaluated at the time you file suit. And there was no redressability because the way that the statute was going to be enforced hadn't been implemented through the executive office, through regulations.
Meaning there wasn't maybe punishments in place for violating the dictates of the act.
How it was going to be enforced had not been determined yet. And because of that, the court found we didn't have standing.
Even though that did happen later on.
Yes.
You couldn't retroactively have standing.
We could have dismissed and refiled the suit, but other folks obviously, like, you know, honeyfund.com that just won in the 11th Circuit. And there's another case that was brought by ACLU and NAACP, a guy named Leroy Purnell, I think, is the lead plaintiff. That's now up on appeal for the college aspect of the Stop Woke Act. And other people are carrying the water and running with it, and I wish them well.
Yeah. All right. So the court said that the, you know, in this particular element, it's not legitimate. But there are, you know, this was done by a 3-member panel of the appellate court, and there are some options to request it be heard by the full panel or appealed. Explain to us what legal steps, and the governor hasn't said yet what he intends to do, but what could happen?
Well, there's a couple of options available to the state. They can file for a regular rehearing, which would just rehear it in front of the 3-judge panel, but they've spoken pretty clearly. You're not going to change their mind. The other option would be to have rehearing en banc, which would be the entire 11th Circuit Court of Appeals sitting together to decide the issue. Or they could forego any rehearing and just file a petition for writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court and try to have it heard then. This is my speculation. I suspect that they may move for rehearing en banc and then try to take this before the Supremes.
And so en banc would be to, you know, perhaps find some more sympathetic judges to hear the case. But it's worth pointing out, you know, that the circuit judge that wrote this decision was a Trump appointee. And there's no question about his, you know, conservative bona fides. I mean, one of the arguments that they made in their decision relied on a case from Boca Raton where they overturned that city's ban on conversion therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was a decision that obviously aligned with a more conservative outlook. But this,
if I may, the other opinion that they cite of 11th Circuit precedent was the restriction that was formerly in place on physicians asking patients about their firearm ownership. Once again, a very conservative concept that they shot down. So
that was the docs with Glocks or docs versus Glocks, right? That doctors weren't allowed to ask their patients, do you safely store your gun? Do you own a gun? Florida put the kibosh on asking those kind of questions. And then the court said,
you can't do that. It violates the First Amendment. I think that case was Walsh-Lager.
Mm-hmm. So there wouldn't necessarily be a great likelihood that, you know, given the conservative makeup of this 3-panel hearing it with a larger group of all of the jurists would change the outcome.
The law is bad, and I don't know that that matters what political affiliation you're in. It violates the First Amendment.
So let's talk about how this dovetails in some ways with other initiatives that the state has taken on that have to do with First Amendment rights. One of them is what's known colloquially as the Don't Say Gay Act, which is a prohibition on certain teachings, mentions of being gay in the classroom for certain class levels. What else have we seen? You sort of mentioned DEI briefly, but what other initiatives are in this vein of things that should be verboten in the state of Florida?
And it's kind of a spectrum. Like the Stop Woke Act, I think, is just bad on its face because the government's engaging in viewpoint discrimination, and that's just never a good idea. Likewise, the what's colloquially been referred to as the "don't say gay," I think is bad. Kind of like our case, the district court judge Windsor in that case found that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to bring it. That's now up on appeal at the 11th Circuit as well. There's another aspect of Stop Woke regarding the college instruction on the prohibited concepts. That's also before the 11th Circuit. But in that vein, you also have the stripping the Reedy Creek District of its governing authority and restoring that to the state. That's a spinoff of their criticism of don't say gay.
That's the Disney case.
Disney case. And then you have the statute that permits parents to object to books. And we've seen the fallout from that with, you know, schools showing pictures of just empty bookshelves while these reviews are going on. That's also being challenged. And looking at this, as of June of last year, over $17 million in fees have been paid by the state to litigate this stuff in the courts. And that's June of last year. It's clearly going to be north of $20 million as we sit here today. So there's just a lot of funding being expended on this culture wars. And that, I don't even think that accounts for the migrant flights that we're paying for out of other states. So there's just a plethora of these types of statutes that have been challenged at great taxpayer expense.
We're talking about Stop Woke. You are welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. It's worth mentioning your law firm was the law firm that fought for the right for gay people to get married. That was your firm. That was
correct. Yeah, that was Brenner versus Scott. And it initially started as a lawsuit to try to recognize gay marriages performed out of state, recognized in the jurisdiction where they were performed. And we were sought out by other plaintiffs, and we expanded that into recognizing the right of gay marriage straight up. We weren't the firm that brought the case before the Supreme Court. That was Obergefell and a different plaintiffs out of a different state. But as a result of that decision and our litigation in Florida, we were the ones that legalized gay marriage in Florida.
So I want to get into a little bit of the college level application of Stop Woke and where that argument has gone, because you find that particularly interesting. And I think that even though a lot of people view Stop Woke generally as an infringement on the First Amendment, we're talking about college professors here. And explain to us the argument that the state is making.
In unlike the case that just came down, honeyfun.com, where they argued, we're not regulating speech, we're regulating conduct. With respect to the educational aspects of it, and in particular, the live issue on appeal is the college age students and the college professors. What the state is claiming in that case is rather remarkable, in that they're arguing in court that the professors and likewise the students have no independent First Amendment rights, that whatever the teachers or the professors instruct is government speech, not the professor, but it's government speech, so they can completely control whatever these individuals say in their classroom. And that's a rather breathtaking approach to academic freedom and what we've associated with colleges as being a place that fosters a lot of diverse ideas, the marketplace of ideas, if you will, and the government saying, no, 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 we can completely control all aspects of education and ideology on a college campus.
So they're basically asserting that professors, college professors, don't have any First Amendment rights.
Correct. That's scary.
Well, but it does sound like maybe not completely as cut and dried as you might think hearing that. I mean, we place great faith in the First Amendment. We also, as you say, place great faith in academic freedom in the classroom. And college campuses are a place that you expect to hear more ideas. But there are attorneys that think that the state has a good case when it's asserting that right. So it's not, you know, maybe as cut and dried as you might think. Explain to us what goes into that gray area that might say professors don't have a First Amendment right.
The gray area would be, and I don't know that it's very gray. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that's bad juju as well. But what they're saying is, because we are the government institution that provides this education, we can control what gets said in that environment, that they are in control. That's it. Full stop. That we don't have to countenance any dissident ideas from our professors.
But there is a case law that that the state is pointing to that would allow for, you know, restraining employees of the state. Right?
Well, they're relying on case law that says that the university can set what courses are going to be given and the type of subject matter that they want instruction on. But they've never gone to this level of minutia to control that, okay, we're going to have this course. Now, here's what you can say in it, as opposed to authorizing it generally. We're going to provide for this course, this instruction, but now here's how you have to deliver it.
The comparison, I believe, that's made sometimes, though, is someone like an anchor at a public, you know, television station reading a script, that being not really in their wheelhouse to like decide one way or the other, that they're tasked with this job and they're going to read from the script. And I think that that legally is kind of a comparison that's sometimes made with professors in the classroom.
And that is where the tension lies. At what level, if any, do these professors have academic freedom to discuss the topic more fully than what script is given to you by the government?
We've got a call, Eugene, on the north side. Good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning to all. Got a quick, brief comment. I was listening to some of the numbers that your person on staff with you this morning mentioned about the amount of money that has been spent from a legal aspect. You can fund some organization's total balance for a year, and probably so, and your pay raises. That's absurd, the amount of money, government and funds being spent on these projects. And two, it's before this is all said and done, I know this is apples and oranges, but it's going to turn some arrows at this JEA project. And I take your comments off the air. Have a good day.
Thanks, Eugene. Appreciate that. These are private law firms primarily that are being hired to argue these cases. Is that right?
There's one with respect to the Stop Woke Act. There's a particular law firm out of Washington, D.C., although its principal resides, like many of the high-ranking conservatives, in Naples, Florida. I don't know what it is about that town that draws that. But it's Cooper and Kirk, and they're charging the state $752 an hour.
All right. Keith in Riverside, good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. Good morning. I'd just like to point out that the state of Florida has never defined, I don't think it's defined anywhere in the law, what exactly woke is supposed to mean in terms of stopping it. The lawyers for the state acknowledge that the definition of woke was the one that was in the dictionary, which is something that you can't regulate, being attuned or supportive of social justice issues. And I also think it's rich that the state of Florida has three holidays honoring the Confederacy and the Confederates, which is, in my mind, indoctrinating people into supporting or agreeing with the Confederacy. But Governor DeSantis never said anything about removing Confederate monuments until he withdrew his campaign. And then all of a sudden, all these bills come forward about restoring the monuments and so forth and so on. So one type of indoctrination is fine, but the other is verboten.
Thanks, Keith. Appreciate that.
And he's hitting right on the point that the 11th Circuit did, is that this is viewpoint discrimination, meaning that the government is completely prohibiting one set of views from being expressed, while ones that are in line with the current government power structure can go unfettered. And that's what the basis of finding this unconstitutional is that you can't have that type of viewpoint discrimination where the government puts its thumb on the scale in stating what can be discussed.
This is a case, you know, this is an act and a law that is primarily playing out in the courts with lawyers and judges making these decisions. Is there anything that ordinary people should either be following, paying attention to, or doing if they are concerned about laws that step on First Amendment rights.
Like anything else in a democratic system, get out the vote. You can try to, you know, politic your local legislatures to express your disagreement with this stuff, but I don't know that that's going to fall on receptive ears. And so in a democratic system, the ultimate arbiter is voting.
Do you think that this issue has perhaps crested now that the governor is no longer seeking the nation's highest office?
Oh, I think this is, I think it's very obvious what had happened. This statute and the similar comparator ones, the don't say gay and all that, were rolled out in anticipation of what we now know was Governor DeSantis's presidential run. And this is a way to try to establish a platform for his campaign before he had any kind of national office so that he could draw, you know, and we've seen the debates with Governor Gavin Newsom out of California, where he could plant his flag. This is going to be my, these are, you know, my platforms on my campaign. Here's what I'm running on. And I don't know that a whole lot of consideration went into the legality of it. This seems to be a whole lot of politics.
Matt Kachurgis, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
We'll be back in just a minute with reporter David Bauerlein on the latest from JEA. Welcome back. The federal corruption case against JEA's two former highest-ranking executives enters its third week after days of scorching testimony. I'm joined now by David Bauerlein, Metro columnist at the Florida Times Union, and a reporter who began covering the JEA scandal long before federal prosecutors filed charges. David, welcome.
Good to be here, Ann.
Good to have you. So last week was about as exciting as it gets for a white-collar criminal case. What are some of your big takeaways?
Yeah, it was a lot of action-packed testimony as white-collar criminal trials go. You're absolutely right, Ann. So the big takeaways were the testimony from former general counsel Jason Gabriel, who was, as the city's top lawyer, going back and forth with Aaron Zahn back in 2019 about whether this ill-fated incentive plan, which is the heart of the prosecution, was actually legal or not. And so Jason Gabriel recounted some expletive-laden meetings, some anger, as he described it, on the part of Aaron Zahn, the former CEO, that the plan was not legal, that could not be implemented. Jason Gabriel also often characterized himself as, quote, duped and deceived, unquote, which I think is something that will probably show up both literally and thematically in the state's closing arguments in this case. His oral argument has been there was a very public plan and there was a very secret plan, and that the secret plan was being kept under wraps as much as possible and eventually was smoked out by various groups looking into it, including whether it was actually legal or not. So I thought his testimony was really going to be strong towards the state's characterization of the case. And then, of course, there was the witness who did not remember anything, essentially, or in the case of former JEA board member Camille Lee Johnson, pleaded the Fifth Amendment against her right against self-incrimination. And that was kind of an interesting case because she was at the crossroads of so much of this back in 2019.
So she was not just a board member. She actually chaired the compensation committee for JEA. So she was the one that theoretically would have known the content of this planned, this you know, benefit plan.
Right, exactly. That's precisely why she would have been right there, right of not only was one of the board members who voted to seek offers for JEA, but as chairwoman of the compensation committee, was there sort of vetting this plan as it was evolving. Now, the actual plan that was presented to the JEA board at its July 2019 meeting was not the plan that the compensation committee had seen before then. So obviously the prosecutors wanted to know, what did she know about the plan? What conversations did she have with Aaron Zahn or former Chief Financial Officer Ryan Wanamaker, who's also on trial. And that was where they got just repeatedly her invoking the Fifth Amendment.
She invoked the Fifth a number of times. She also said she couldn't recall the name of JEA's attorney. She wouldn't say what being compensation committee chair entailed. And she said she didn't remember what a performance unit was. How plausible does a jury find that? I mean, granted, 2019 was a while ago, but this was a highly publicized case. It was reported on, extensively by your paper and other outlets. It was the subject of a grand jury investigation. These people have been asked to testify before the city council investigatory committee. Is there any question as to whether, these memories are failing or just not being shared?
Yes, obviously there would be question about that. I mean, this was a historic episode for JEA, for the city. It was highly reported, headlines all over the place. Now, the jury will not hear this, evidently, because she testified it on Friday outside the jury. It does not appear that she's going to be called as one of the state's witnesses. Her argument in a motion she filed with the court last week is that she was on JEA after she left JEA. The pandemic was there. She's in the restaurant business. She was really neck deep and trying to save her restaurants. And she, quote, quickly forgot what happened to JEA. And this is something where even a year after 2019, when she was interviewed by the FBI, the U.S. attorney, state attorney's investigators, they did the 6-page report that basically said she could not remember a lot of really of substantive stuff that they were asking her about. So, is it plausible that somebody would sort of have this kind of memory wipe after leaving JEA? That's her argument at the very least. Would it be compelling to a jury? That's a question we're not going to find out because she's not going to be called as a witness. It doesn't appear.
She's not the only one who's had a failed memory. I mean, former city council president Kevin Hyde also was called to testify. He was an advisor on the sale, repeatedly said, "I don't recall." He was weeds deep in this case.
He was. And so Kevin did not plead the Fifth Amendment. He did not. It's possible people do not recall things. There was a lot going on, the whole drinking water from a fire hose analogy. When you have those sort of I don't remember, it does sort of raise questions about, well, why not? I mean, you were there right at the crossroads, right there on the front lines of all these deliberations. So certainly the kind of witness that you would most want to hear from in these type of cases, especially because, again, the whole case from the prosecution is that there was this very public presentation and there was this very secret presentation, and they're trying to show over and over again what people knew in public and then what they had no idea was happening sort of beneath the surface of these public deliberations.
Yeah, and so a key witness on the behind-the-scenes element was Stephen Amger. He's the former roommate of Aaron Zahn, the former CEO of JEA, and he took the stand to testify about a conversation that he had with Aaron Zahn. He was being called in possibly to be, consulting on some of this stuff with his company. He's a lawyer. And he says that Aaron Zahn told him something really significant. What kind of testimony did he bring, and how significant was that for the jury?
Well, I think it was significant for the jury. So Stephen Amger essentially testified that several months before this all kind of emerged as JEA potentially being for sale, that Aaron Zahn had told him that he had the sort of the support from the mayor to get about $40 million off the sale, eventually to benefit personally from the sale. Now, Mayor Curry has emphatically denied that conversation ever took place. But the significance for the jury would be that...
Well, to be clear, he didn't deny the conversation took place between Amger and Zahn. He has said he never was aware. He said that didn't happen, I think is the phrase he's used repeatedly. That did not happen.
Exactly. Yes. Thanks for clarifying that, Ann. Mayor Curry has said he never told Aaron Zahn that it's okay with me if you make $40 million off the sale of JEA. But the significance of that would be for the jury that obviously the question throughout has been, was the state's case has been that Aaron Zahn was sort of guiding JEA, driving JEA towards this posture of let's go seek bids, let's put JEA up for sale, and that simultaneous with that, he was pushing forward this incentive plan that would have enriched him and other JEA employees, but certainly himself in the state's case, with this massive financial windfall that it's just unheard of in the sale of a government asset that you would have that kind of personal gain being involved in the picture in any way.
And Amdur also testified that Zahn told him that the mayor was also okay with his senior leadership team at JEA making many millions of dollars themselves as well. How important is it that Amdur is a former close buddy of Aaron Zahn? I mean, they were roommates.
Yeah, they were roommates when they were both going to school at Yale University as undergraduates. It would sort of perhaps lend to the credibility of the statement from the standpoint that they knew each other and that there was something where Aaron Zahn would have felt comfortable making that kind of statement. He wasn't just any lawyer. It was somebody he had a friendship with and knew about. And Pillsbury, the firm that Stephen Amdur works for, did eventually become one of the law firms that was hired by JEA to provide legal guidance as they were navigating the potential sale of the utility.
So this is a case that has no cameras in the courtroom. It's federal court. A lot of us are relying on the reporting that you are doing and the other reporters in the courtroom. What are you expecting this week? How close are we getting to the end of the government's case?
Very close. So assuming things go as scheduled, the government will have two witnesses that they'll still call to the stand, former Chief Administrative Officer Herschel Vineyard and former Human Resources Vice President John Kendrick. And then they would rest their case. The defense then has talked about putting on an expert witness who's going to kind of deconstruct the notorious incentive plan and kind of show that maybe it wasn't as lucrative as this being portrayed. There's also a possibility that there will be some statements presented to the jury that Aaron Zahn made back in January 2020 that Ryan Wanamaker believes are helpful to his case. And so it's kind of a weird trial where you have two juries, and there's possibility that one of the juries that's hearing the evidence is Aaron Zahn would leave the courtroom so that the jury that's deciding the guilt or innocence of Ryan Wanamaker would stay. It's kind of an interesting type of novel situation from that standpoint. But, you know, we could have, depending on how many witnesses the defense has, we could be getting to closing arguments this week.
Well, you can read David Bauerlein in the Florida Times Union. David, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back in just a minute with an advanced look at Daniel Tiger's neighborhood as it comes to Jacksonville. I'm joined now by one of Jacksonville's most prolific and unusual historians, whose writing has captured some of the city's least known and yet most important stories. Tim Gilmore is a professor, author of several books, and founder of the Jacks by Jacks Literary Festival. Tim, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Anne. Great to be here.
Great to have you back. So you've written several times about a local architect, Robert Broward, and we're going to talk about a specific structure that he built. He built a lot of structures around Jacksonville. So for people who aren't familiar with him, why don't you give us a little primer on kind of who he was and what buildings he built that we might recognize?
Sure, yeah. Robert Broward was really an iconic Jacksonville architect. He came from kind of an iconic old Jacksonville family. But as an architect, he studied with Frank Lloyd Wright really focused on making every structure about the site that it was on, very focused on the natural environment, and even in his own thinking was almost kind of neo-pagan, you know, in some ways. His favorite structure of his designs was the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville on Arlington Expressway. That's a incredible, beautiful structure that really symbolizes what he was all about architecturally. He also designed the auditorium for Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. He did, through his 60 years all around Florida and in other parts of the country, more than 500 designs. So really prolific and really iconic Jacksonville artist.
And you talk about almost kind of a pagan approach to architecture. I know that you talk in some of your blogs about the building of the Unitarian Universalist Church and how prior to coming up with conceiving the idea for that structure, he actually went out and spent the night in the woods there.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. He had had a car accident right before designing the church. He had type 1 diabetes, and he would go into a diabetic reaction at times, but he usually could read the tells ahead of time. He had a reaction, had an accident, and started sketching the design for the church in the hospital. And he felt like this was kind of a second chance sort of, you know, situation. And he absolutely went out and camped on the site. It's right on a creek, kind of with, you know, as much of a hill as you get in Jacksonville. Got to know the trees and got to know the situatedness of the site. And that was crucial for him to kind of, you know, actually almost listen to the place in order to think about what it needed.
So over, you say, a 60-year career, designed more than 500 buildings. He was influenced by a couple of really prominent architects. Talk about his style.
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned that he studied with Frank Lloyd Wright. And I think if you were doing any kind of architecture in the United States in the second half of the 20th century, you were influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright, you know. But he actually studied with him. And he also knew and did a study himself of the work of Henry John Clutho, who Wright was known for doing prairie style architecture. Clutho brought the prairie style to Florida, and Clutho's buildings are although Jacksonville has destroyed a lot of them, they're still, you know, all around the city. So he worked with both architects and developed his own style from that. You can definitely see the influence, also he fits into what people call mid-century modern now, which is kind of this wide, broad phrase. It's a catch-all for lots of movements in the middle of the 20th century.
So he built a lot of homes, he built a lot of buildings, but waited until he was almost 70 to design his own residence. Tell us what it was called, and why did he wait that long to do that?
Right. He actually lived in a small structure that already existed in Switzerland, not the Switzerland you're probably thinking of, but the Switzerland that's in St. John's County, just underneath Jacksonville. And he added on to it and kept kind of experimenting with it for years, throughout the 70s. And he said in a Florida Times Union story in the mid 80s that he was probably going to demolish it. And he had these ideas for the house that he wanted to build there. The ideas were completely different from what he later ended up building. He talked about it being octagonal, and he said it would be like living in a spider's web. He ended up moving into town really because he was looking at his own health situations and the way his type 1 diabetes was changing over the years. It was becoming harder and harder for him to have those tells and to realize, you know, when one was coming on. So he instead of spending more time on commutes, he bought a site in town.
Very close to the Hart Bridge.
Yes, right. Yeah. And it's It's on the Arlington side of things, on Mayfair Road.
And it's called?
It's called Waka Palatka, which is kind of an appropriation of what Seminole Indians called a site where downtown Jacksonville is now, which translates to Calford, right? And people often say that Jacksonville was first called Calford, which is not exactly true, but that site was called the Calford.
So that's the name he took. And what does the building look like?
Yeah, it's a really interesting building. It's not his most avant-garde or radical building, you know. It's very homey. There's a focus on the horizontal, as is the case with prairie style stuff, and so that the roof line and you know, there are these wide eaves and these kinds of horizontal bands that you see. He's also got, you know, there's a water feature out front. I mean, he talked throughout the years about some of his architectural materials as being sunlight and rain and
kind of an environmental design.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think of Taylor Hardwick, another, you know, architect from Jacksonville who designed around trying to, I don't know, accommodate the Florida weather. But
that's,
I think
exactly
you said,
right,
that his electric bill never rose above $18 a month.
Yeah, that's when he was. That's what he said about when he lived out at Switzerland. And part of this is because you know, he didn't really use air conditioning or in the winter heating that much. He really was you know, tuned into what you know. It's easier, I think, to be all about nature when you're in a really comfortable place. It's harder sometimes in Florida in the summer, right? He actually, toward the end of his life, broke his neck when he was sunbathing nude on top of his house, on top of Waka Palatka. So his daughter told me, you know, that man worshipped the sun. She also said he hated clothes. So
you're bound to wind up with a broken back at some point if you're nude sunbathing on the roof.
On the roof. Yeah. Luckily, he didn't fall off the roof or anything like that. But I think it's something that his family still, you know, I think they laugh about it. And it is very telling of who he was and his personality.
Well, architect Robert Broward is just one of many stories that Tim Gilmore tells on his blog, Jack Psychogeo, which has hundreds of posts now.
At the moment, 727.
All right. Tim Gilmore, thanks so much for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
We appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at TerrellHogan.com.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Hey, hey, it's Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. I know you rely on NPR and this station for the latest news you need to know, but it's giving so much more for your body.
These movement breaks work.
and soul.
My mind just gets to float to somewhere else.
Please help us keep this head-to-toe public service freely available to everyone by making your donation today. Here's how.
Please call 904-353-9528 and thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, comic, writer, director, and actor Julio Torres talks about the absurd obstacles he faced in the U.S. immigration system after coming to the States from El Salvador. He satirizes the system in his new film, Problemista. He formerly wrote for Saturday Night Live and co-wrote and starred in HBO's Los Espookies. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Georgia votes on Tuesday in the presidential primary, but election drama is still playing out there from 2020.
The flame that Giuliani lit with those lies and passed to so many others changed every aspect of our lives.
We hear from election officials in Georgia. That's next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. A series inspired by Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, based on the beloved character Daniel Striped Tiger, is now a musical and it's coming to Jacksonville. Amanda Lupacino portrays the title character in the Emmy-winning PBS series Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, and she joins us now by phone. Hey, Amanda, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So glad to have you. So, Amanda, you've played a lot of roles in your professional career. You've been in musicals like A Chorus Line and West Side Story. You've been in some TV shows and film, including Monsters Inside Me. What makes the character of Daniel Tiger unique among the roles that you've played?
Daniel Tiger is special for me, I think, because I grew up on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So it's something that I can pull from childhood, and it's for the newer generation. And none of the roles I've played before, I really grew up on. So I think that's what makes it special for me.
So I also grew up on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And Daniel Tiger, Striped Tiger, was, you know, a central character, really kind of a beloved character. One of the puppets that, you know, really embodied more than any of them, I think, the character of Mr. Rogers himself. And so how does that translate into the role? And how do you kind of evoke that in your performance?
Yeah, I think, you know, we, throughout the show, there's a lot of pieces of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that anyone that watched that growing up will recognize. But the biggest message we pull through is kindness. And I think that a lot of the messages that Mr. Rogers had throughout his show, we bring forth in ours through different scenarios, and we get the kids to help us out with those scenarios, and they learn some of the things that Mr. Rogers, you know, taught us as kids.
So you wear a tiger costume in this, of course, including a pretty big headpiece that covers your face. I just got to ask, like, how do you perform in that? It's got to be hot. How did you adapt to the physical demands of the role?
Yeah, it was a really rigorous learning process. I've been doing this role for 5 years now, since 2018. So I've had a lot of experience at this point, but learning to perform for an hour and a half in a 20 to 30 pound costume was not an easy feat. And I am very, very, very sweaty, as I'm sure you can imagine by the end. I actually had to increase my calorie intake when I started because I was just like dropping weight and I couldn't keep up with the physical demands.
So it's
been a learning process. Yeah, I've had to learn how to take care of my body in a way that allows me to do the show and keep up with it. And I'm in the best shape of my life. It's the most physically demanding thing I've ever done and that I will ever do, I'm sure. But yeah, it's pretty wild.
And that's intense to say. I mean, for somebody who is in A Chorus Line, which has got to be pretty physically demanding as well.
Yes, for sure.
So the musical is called King for a Day. What is the plot and what characters can people who attend expect to see from sort of the world of make-believe?
Yeah, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood Live, King for a Day, follows Daniel in the land of make-believe with his friends as he prepares to play the role of the king in his school play. And throughout this day, he kind of comes into a few obstacles along the way and has to make choices. And the kids, you know, we get the kids involved. We ask them to help us, you know, clap if you think we should do this, or what do you think we should do? And yeah, by the end of the show, you get to see kind of a play within a play, which is always fun. And, you know, you'll get to kind of a recap of all the lessons he's learned throughout the show. And as for characters, I think I was trying to count before you picked up. I think there's 15 or 16 characters you'll recognize throughout the show, but some of the, you know, bigger ones that the kids and parents will recognize are Katarina, Oh the Owl, Miss Elena, Chrissy, Teacher Harriet, King Friday, Baker Acre, Mr. McFeely, Prince Wednesday. Those are some of the, you know, larger roles that everyone will recognize.
Yeah. Are there any shows, anything that this TV series doesn't feature? Any new songs that that you can expect that the audience will hear?
Yeah, in our stage version, there are original songs that aren't in the TV show that you can only hear if you come to see our show. And then, of course, there are a lot of songs that everyone will recognize that are even from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that have been carried on through Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. So there's a good mix of original music that hasn't been heard before and, you know, music from the TV shows.
Well, you can see Daniel Tiger and his friends in King for a Day at the Florida Theater in partnership with WJCT. The musical is staged March 24th at 2:00, and tickets are available. I've been speaking to Amanda Lupacino. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a great show.
Thank you.
That's our program. We encourage you to send feedback or suggestions to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast, or you can find our entire archive at WJCT.org and on any podcast platform. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our director is Brady Corum. Join us again Tuesday when we get the lowdown on the winners and losers of Florida's legislative session. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.